2 years ago, we were in the thick of the 2016 presidential election, the primaries to be exact. And as Donald Trump solidified his lead, he often returned to one story.
Just imagine for a second if the media spent this energy holding the politicians accountable who got innocent Americans like Kate Steinle killed. She was gunned down by an illegal immigrant who had been deported 5 times.
Turning a horrific case into political fodder is not just an American phenomenon. Earlier this spring, it happened in Germany. On the night of May 22nd in the small town of Mainz in western Germany, a 14-year-old girl went missing.
Susanna F., and that's just F because in Germany we have privacy codes for the victims of crimes. So she's a 14-year-old girl, and she went out with her friends in Wiesbaden, which is a city near her hometown of Mainz. And her mother reported her missing when she didn't come home on May 22nd. About a week later, her body was found near a refugee home in Wiesbaden, where the suspect, called Ali B., lived. There are unsubstantiated rumors that the two knew each other, but we don't know that for sure. And they also found out that the suspect's asylum claim had been rejected and he should have been deported, but because of a backlog of deportation orders, he was still in Germany.
News of Susanna's story spread quickly around the country.
So just like when any of these cases happen, they completely, because also violent crime is so uncommon in Germany, they completely dominate the news for days. And what was particularly noticeable in the case of Susanna is how much false information got out there. I mean, first this 25-year-old Turkish man was arrested, then a 13-year-old Iraqi refugee, you know, a lot of false leads. People were publishing, I think, without thinking about what could happen to these people who were accused without being guilty. And, you know, people, the obvious and very clear reaction is shock from across Germany, again, because this happens so seldom.
The case, and others like it, have undermined German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her efforts to help refugees in the country. But it's also become a rallying point for the far-right Alternative for Germany Party, or the AfD, to continue to use rare and isolated incidents like this to stoke hatred against specific groups.
This has elicited the typical protect our wives and daughters from these savages rhetoric from the AfD, and they've used it as a way to whip up support against Merkel. And there have been similar cases about every 6 months the past 2 years. And each time the far right has used it to call for anti-immigrant demonstrations and to call for Merkel to step down.
Where are the world's leaders when it comes to our global migrant crisis? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We're in Minnesota at NPR Studios, and today, a look at how the far right in both Germany and the United States are defining the immigration debate not only at home, but around the world. Elizabeth Schumacher is a domestic politics reporter for DW News in Germany and has been covering the confluence of migration and the rise of the far right in Germany for the past 4 years. She joins us from Cologne. And Christian Martin is a professor of political science at the University of Kiel in Germany, who's also been working at New York University since 2016.
I think what we're seeing is that throughout the West, there are strong forces on the right who use this rhetoric in order to advance their policy goals, which is to restrict migration. These forces think that the time of open borders and really an open world has come to an end, or should come to an end, and they are drawing on each other's rhetoric to advance their policy goals.
Now, I just want to make sure we see if we can put this in perspective. Has there actually been an increase in crime committed by people who aren't legal residents of Germany? Is there proof that this is actually bigger than this one case?
No, there's absolutely not. If we look at the data, we find that crime overall, it's at its lowest since 1992. So Germany is a very safe country, and it's safer today than it has ever been since 92.
If you look at reports from the federal police, they say obviously, you know, refugee crime is slightly up, but that's because there are more refugees. And what this crime is, if you look at the actual reports, is very minor things like not paying for a bus ticket or shoplifting from the corner store. There has not been any uptick in violent crime.
And I want to read a tweet from the President of the United States yesterday, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'd love for you both to sort of pick this apart if you could. Quote, "The people of Germany are turning against their leadership as migration is rocking the already tenuous Berlin coalition. Crime in Germany is way up. Big mistake made all over Europe in allowing millions of people in who have so strongly and violently changed their culture."
Yeah, I mean, this is far away from anything that you would call the truth. Crime is not way up. We've talked about this. Migration is an important issue, but it's not defining the political discourse. It is at the moment, but when we think back to the coalition negotiations, migration was not one of the major contentious points. So the policy debate that we're seeing now is largely due to the CSU, the sister party of Angela Merkel's CDU, having to stand elections in their home state of Bavaria in October. And they're trying to advance a more conservative stance, an anti-immigrant stance, to compete with the AfD because they fear to lose their majority in their home state.
They're sort of conflating two issues here, right? The idea, when I say they, I mean the far right, the idea that immigrants are not just violent, or brown people are not just violent and people who can commit crimes, but also this idea that they, as the president says, strongly and violently changed their culture. The culture element here, I think, is one that we should explore. Elizabeth, what do you see on the ground in Germany as far as culture? Is it a multicultural society? Is it one where Germans are feeling threatened by immigration?
So, I mean, since 2015, since the refugee crisis, the overwhelming response amongst Germans has been, you know, because of our history, we have a special responsibility to accept people and to accept refugees. And most Germans you talk to will accept this. You have some places, maybe rural places, where in a small village they had to accept 1,000 refugees, and that was really difficult for them, and they might feel like they weren't being listened to. But Germany has had a Muslim population since the great wave of Turkish migration in the 1970s. I mean, you see hijab, you see mosques. Most places I've been to in Germany, everyone's very tolerant, and it's a very multicultural place. And nobody I've ever spoken to is like, I've spoken to AfD supporters who say they feel less safe, but I've heard no one who's like, oh, I can't, I'm less German, or my Germanness is being threatened.
And I'm sure you've both seen the reports coming out of the United States about these tent cities that are being essentially put up for children who are being separated from their parents at the border, at the southern border in the United States. Lots of people are looking at that in terror and saying this is reminiscent of what happened in Germany in concentration camps. And there are Jewish scholars that are saying it's not so far off to actually, start to draw those parallels. Are those parallels being drawn in Germany right now?
I have not heard anything out of Germany. I have heard rebukes of those comparisons, because the singularity of the Holocaust is something that Germans are very aware of and sensitive to. So these kinds of comparisons don't go down well with Germans because of the history and because of the magnitude of the crime. That said, it makes you wonder what is going on in the U.S. that something like this is possible. It's absolutely horrendous, and something that Germans are watching in disbelief.
We also are watching whether or not Angela Merkel will lose her seat. If she does, I would like to ask you both, what does that mean for migration issues across the world, in Germany and potentially beyond?
I mean, it's highly unlikely that anything major happens to the German government. Like Christian said before, this is mostly a power play from her interior minister ahead of elections in Bavaria. There was these rumors going around that he's threatening to pull his party, which is, again, a smaller sister party of her own party, out of the government, you know, whether or not that will actually happen, I think is pretty unlikely.
Yeah, I would agree. The German constitution is all about stability, and it's surprisingly hard to get rid of a chancellor. You need to have a person that enjoys the support of a majority of the parliament before you can oust the sitting chancellor. The Green Party has already announced that they might be willing to step in if the CSU, the sister party, leaves the coalition. So I don't see Angela Merkel losing her office anytime soon.
Elisabeth Schumacher is a domestic politics reporter for DW News in Germany, and Christian Martin is a political science professor at the University of Kiel in Germany and a visiting professor at New York University. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You just heard Elisabeth Schumacher in Cologne say that separating children from their parents under any circumstances would be political suicide in Germany. Apparently, that's not the same in the United States. Even as outcry mounts across the political system, a new poll out yesterday found that 55% of Republicans support the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy at the border, which includes separating children from their parents. I want you all to listen to what this sounds like, and giving you a warning, it's very tough to hear. I don't want them to stop my father. I don't want them to deport him, a child cries out. ProPublica obtained the audio of 10 Central American children separated from their parents by U.S. authorities and who are now being held in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection detention facility. This was taped there last week. The person who made the recording asked not to be identified and gave it to a well-known lawyer who gave it to ProPublica. That person estimated the children on the recording are between 4 and 10 years old.
Bueno, aquí tenemos una orquesta.
The man's voice at the end there is a Border Patrol agent, and he says, well, we have an orchestra here, right? What's missing is a conductor. You can listen to the full audio by going to ProPublica.org. And something I think has been missing from this debate is how these policies started with the administration's use of dangerous and dehumanizing rhetoric against Latinos. I tweeted about this yesterday, and thousands of you have responded. You can go check it out at Tanzina Vega. We will continue our coverage of this crisis tomorrow on The Takeaway.
Hey, we need your help. You are a big part of this show. How we think about things, and how we choose what to cover. Got an idea or a guest we should talk to? Get with us on our Facebook page or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is your takeaway.
A years-long debate comes to a head here in Minnesota this week over the fate of a pipeline. Enbridge Energy wants to replace its aging Line 3 pipeline, which carries crude oil from Canada's tar sands region to the near Minnesota-Wisconsin border. But the proposed route for the new line has outraged environmentalists and Native Americans. Now regulators in Minnesota are deciding its fate. Dan Crocker is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News who's been following this every step of the way. Dan, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So bring us back to the beginning of this. What is the argument? Are we looking to replace a pipeline, get rid of a pipeline, fix a pipeline?
So in a nutshell, Enbridge Energy, this Canadian company, they have this, it's called Line 3, the pipeline. It's over 50 years old. It's cracking. It's corroding. It's had some big spills in the past. So Enbridge wants to replace it, but they want to replace it with a bigger pipeline that's going to be able to carry nearly twice as much oil, and they want to put it along a new route across northern Minnesota. So it's a replacement, but it's also an expansion, and that expansion part of it is what is part of what has angered a lot of the opponents of this.
Now, whenever we talk about pipelines these days, I can't help but think about what happened at Standing Rock. So there was a lot of environmental pressure on that. Now, what are environmentalists saying about this particular pipeline?
Well, there's a couple main arguments. They are concerned about the threat of spills. The threat of a catastrophic spill is rare, but it happens. And this pipeline travels across northern Minnesota, which, if anyone's been there, knows is replete with lakes and rivers and really pristine areas. So that's a number one concern. Also, the climate change impacts. Oil from the tar sands region of Canada is more carbon intensive. It's a heavy crude, takes more energy to extract. So it's a similar argument, actually, to the Keystone XL pipeline, another pipeline folks may have heard about, in that there a lot of folks are concerned about the climate change impact. So those, from the environmental perspective, those are two of the main concerns.
You mentioned Standing Rock, also wondering if there is intense pushback from the Native American community. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a huge component of this. So this travels through northern Minnesota. There are 5 Ojibwe bands that have reservations in northern Minnesota. It gets complicated. So the proposed new route does not travel directly through reservations, but it travels through land that tribes used to occupy. There are a lot of important cultural sites. Wild rice is a huge deal among tribes in northern Minnesota, a lot of pristine wild rice waters. But, so most tribes are vehemently opposed and have threatened protests like Standing Rock. However, the current pipeline actually travels through 2 reservations. One of those Indian tribes is called the Leech Lake Band, and it's nuanced. They would prefer to have the new pipeline away from their reservation rather than having this old line that's prone to leaks continue to operate through their reservation.
Now, we're going to be watching this week. This decision is going to be made here. Who stands to win if this pipeline is expanded or fixed?
Sure. Well, Enbridge is the pipeline company, so they're obviously the main entity that stands to win, and the decision is expected next week. But it's also, there are a lot of economic impacts here. I mean, this is a multi-billion-dollar infrastructure project, thousands of construction jobs. So there's a big economic impact to Minnesota as well, that regulators, these decision makers, are weighing against some of the environmental concerns and tribal concerns that we talked about.
And what's your take? What's your takeaway? Should I say, are we thinking this is going to pass?
I mean, 10 years ago, these types of energy infrastructure projects would likely get rubber stamped. But it's sort of a new era. These pipelines have become really larger symbols of this fight, you know, with Native American concerns, climate concerns, these environmental concerns. And there's a lot of questions about, do we really need this oil with electric vehicles and other technologies coming online? So to be honest, I'm as curious, and I really don't know what to anticipate.
Dan Crocker is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News, and he's also on the team behind their new podcast launching today called Rivers of Oil, all about the dramatic conflict around pipelines from Dakota Access to Line 3. Dan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Today is Juneteenth. Do you know what that is?
I've heard the phrase, but I don't know what Juneteenth is, no.
I have no idea. I've never heard of it.
Juneteenth? Nope.
It was automatically added to a U.S. holidays calendar in a calendar I have. I haven't looked it up.
It's about when people were freed.
Juneteenth? Yes.
Juneteenth? Who's he?
I heard it before, but I don't remember. I don't remember what it was about.
Yeah, I have heard about Juneteenth, actually.
It's definitely not something that you learn about in school.
100% no.
Green tea?
Juneteenth.
What's that?
It's like a celebration of freedom, right?
The truth is, a lot of Americans haven't heard of Juneteenth, and that's part of the reason ABC's hit show Black-ish decided to tackle it last fall.
Well, instead of making us celebrate your holidays, why don't you celebrate some of ours? Everybody's represented here. St. Patrick's Day, Columbus Day, Cinco de Mayo. What about Tupac's birthday?
Oh, well.
What about Magic Johnson Still Alive Day?
Really? Earl.
What about Juneteenth?
Maybe you should have led with that last one.
Maybe.
Enslavement. They didn't want us to see how that looked. We were enslaved. So they didn't teach it in the schools because they knew it was wrong.
That's actress Jennifer Lewis, and she plays the straight-talking grandmother, Ruby Johnson, on Black-ish.
And certainly Juneteenth would never have been discussed because, you know, they waited until after a harvest before they told the people that were enslaved. So it's not surprising that a lot of people don't know about Juneteenth, and that's why Black-ish is so important right now.
What she's talking about, what Juneteenth marks, is June 19th, 1865, when Union soldiers landed in Galveston, Texas, with the news that the war was over and that enslaved people were free. That news came 2.5 years after President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Blackish took the Johnson family back to that time, realizing the moment of freedom.
So, what happens now?
Oh, we're free, dummy!
Okay, but what does that mean?
Wait! Pops!
Yeah?
What does that mean?
What does freedom mean? It's a question the entire cast confronted.
When I arrived on the set the first day of shooting, it was haunting. And yet celebratory because we were doing it. But more haunting in that we got to see what it looked like, what the cabins looked like, and how oppressed they truly were. So we had to create new characters. We had to go places inside of ourselves to create those characters. And they were dark, deep places that our ancestors had gone through. I had to become that woman who wore rags between her legs while on her period, still having to run to be free. See, people don't think about that part of it.
And that doesn't surprise Jennifer Lewis. These are stories that many people don't tell and don't know.
What we need is what the writers did and what Kenya Barris did for Juneteenth. They told the truth. It was wrong for them not to tell the enslaved people that they were free because they wanted just one more harvest. Let's keep them, not tell them. Everything about it was wrong. The fact that they didn't teach it in schools were wrong. I didn't know about slavery. Nobody taught me about slavery in school. It might have come up a couple of times. And I went to an all-black school. But was it in the textbooks? No.
But for Jennifer Lewis, the matriarch from Blackish, Juneteenth is a reminder that in spite of human cruelty, there will still be those who choose truth and kindness.
Juneteenth means celebrate. To celebrate humanity. That those people who were in government at the time, that some of them had a soul. They stood up and told the truth, and bravo for them.
Hundreds of people came out to enjoy the 25th annual Juneteenth celebration in Harlem, New York City this past Saturday.
We might be free on paper, but we're not getting our share of America like we should. So every year we want to remind each other of our need to come together as a people and to make real progress here in America.
That's organizer Ade Rasool, and he says Juneteenth could be vital to unifying people of the African diaspora.
There's no other national cry or call that can organize us beyond religion, beyond color, you know, beyond nationality. There's no other religion that's big enough to do that, to cross those lines. So Juneteenth has served as a very good venue that crosses that line and includes all of our diaspora, no matter, you know, what part of the diaspora you associate yourself with. Juneteenth incorporates is an excellent umbrella for us to come underneath.
New York State Senator Brian Benjamin was also present at the celebrations in Harlem. Juneteenth has even more weight for him as a lawmaker.
We over-incarcerate in New York, and we put people in prison and jail who are not just society, and we got to be better about that. So it's all interrelated. But you can't really know where you're going unless you know where you're coming from, and you can't know where you're coming from if you're not familiar with Juneteenth.
The past is certainly still with us, and I think we can definitely do better to learn about our history. Van R. Newkirk II wrote a piece in The Atlantic last year called The Quintessential Americanness of Juneteenth.
It's celebrated as an Emancipation Day. It's celebrated as sort of a nationally representative day of when the slaves were freed. But actually, if you look at the history, it wasn't. It's not legally or actually even practically the day in which most people, enslaved people in America, were freed. So you have the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, which technically frees everybody, but not really, because if you lived in Confederate states, you lived in a rebel state. So it didn't really matter if the federal government had freed you. But then you see over the course of the next 2 years, more and more people become free over the course of the Civil War. There's Memorial Day in April. But Juneteenth actually represents the very last people who are enslaved who become free in Texas. So the fact that it's become sort of the de facto emancipation holiday should tell us that, you know, we're celebrating a delayed emancipation. And that's probably representative of the African-American experience. You know, there are things, people are free, but not quite free. You have the end of slavery, but then we have the beginning of Jim Crow. So I think it's actually a very useful way to think about the way freedom works and how for Black people, especially, it's always been sort of on the horizon.
And is that what makes this holiday, if you will, bittersweet to you?
Oh, yes, definitely. First of all, you had people who before then were unfree, and you can't celebrate their lives and what they'd lived and died for without acknowledging that. But also, again, freedom is a process. It doesn't just happen because people become unenslaved one day. And I think there's not just bittersweetness, but a bit of an idea of collective work that freedom is a collective process.
And in terms of broader recognition of what Juneteenth is, we're seeing TV shows like Black-ish and Atlanta do episodes on Juneteenth. It's on a lot of American iPhone calendars. What do you think is the sort of, what's driving this to be part of the mainstream today?
Now, that's just, if you go back and ask and tell a Black person in 1980 that one day Juneteenth is going to be on their official work calendars, oh, that probably be interesting for them. I think it has, especially in the Black Lives Matter era, more and more folks are trying to think about these cultural touchstones and celebrations that have not entered the mainstream because the mainstream hasn't considered them to be relevant or important. You know, Juneteenth is one of them. But also, you know, you see lots of things. Like, I think it's sort of similar to how Kwanzaa, which is certainly not celebrated by, I don't even think, the majority of African Americans, but still has become a thing that we teach in order to understand how a whole group of people in this country feel differently oriented towards the national identity.
And do you think it's something that is talked about enough in our school curriculums, for example? There's already lots of questions in different states about different types of curriculum as they relate to our history regarding communities of color, Black and brown communities. So is this something that needs to be better taught, or is it something that is already covered, you think?
Well, I think we can always strive to teach better, and especially teach about African-American history, African-American contributions to history, how American history is oriented towards and against African-American advancement. Those are all things that I think, you know, lots of schools don't do quite a great job at. When I was in school, when we ran out of textbooks, we had to use the old ones that still said the War of Northern Aggression.
And I remember that. Oh, my gosh.
Too long ago. Yeah.
It's like, oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And there's still these arguments, right, about, like, whether we're even going to mention slavery in our textbooks. And I do think while social media may be tending towards breaking people out of these bubbles, lots of districts are trying to go in the exact opposite direction, actually.
Now, you are a father. What would you tell your son about Juneteenth?
So I think I would tell him what my father, who is a professor of African-American history, what he always told me. He told me Juneteenth was only one of very many number of celebrations across the country by African-Americans, by Black people, and not just by African-Americans in this country. It's one of several liberation holidays celebrated by a Black diaspora across the world. And you should consider it in that context. When you celebrate Juneteenth, you should think about the people in Haiti who celebrate Liberation Day. And you should think about how it connects and binds a collective group of identities that's built in opposition to a thing.
And that thing is, interestingly, I think we're having a very polarized discussion in our country today, if you will. Where do you put something like Juneteenth in the context of a United States in 2018, where white supremacy is essentially on full display in certain parts of the country?
Well, you can't ignore the valences right now of celebrating Juneteenth, of talking about it, and just where the country's conversation, not just conversation, I think that's a weak word, where the actual racial dynamics are unfolding. And I think you've seen white supremacy, like you say, is emboldened. You have Klansmen and Nazis marching on the streets. And it's, I think it's going to become, especially for people who sort of lived through some of this, people who were older Black folks who were alive during Jim Crow, the idea that young people are going to be out there celebrating liberation, that's, to me, to some of the folks I've talked to, that brings them a renewed sense of hope and also responsibility. There's a lot of work left to be done, clearly, and this celebration, I think, should bring that to the front of everyone's mind.
Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer from The Atlantic covering politics. Thanks for being with us, Van.
Thank you for having me.
And we're super happy to announce the newest member of our Takeaway family, baby Alice Angeline, who was born yesterday during our A segment, to the proud parents, Kim and Amber. Amber is, of course, our planning editor. We wish them the best of luck and congrats and love. Thanks so much for talking with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back tomorrow from NPR in Minnesota.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.